Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. A warm welcome to you. I'm Hady Adams. This week, we will look at the life and legacy of the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We'll speak to his close friend and fellow anti-apartheid activist, Reverend Ellen Busak, about their friendship, their last conversation, and what Tutu's hopes were for his country and the African continent. And from Zimbabwe to Sudan to the United States, we'll bring you a conversation with Hilda Suka Mafudze. She's the African Union ambassador to the United States. She'll tell us about her plans for her time in Washington and her initiative to connect young people across Africa with those in the diaspora. Straight Talk Africa starts now. In my years as a journalist in South Africa, I had the privilege of meeting Archbishop Desmond Tutu just once. But growing up and throughout my life and the lives of many of you watching today, I'm sure, Tutu was an ever-present voice for freedom. He was called South Africa's moral compass and national conscience. He was often irreverent, always rebellious, loved by many, criticized by some. Tutu was a voice not only for liberation, but also for reconciliation. His death on December 26, 2021, at the age of 90, was a loss for all of Africa and the world.
Oh, we lift our hands, we raise our hands, we raise our hands and we say, we will be free!
Desmond Tutu was thrust into the limelight in 1978, when he was appointed Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches. Since that appointment, until his death, Tutu used sharp wit and a mischievous sense of humor to speak truth to power. During South Africa's struggle for liberation, Tutu used plain-spoken logic to call out apartheid government leaders and their segregationist policies.
And if Mr. Smith thinks that our people to some extent are inferior to white, then I would like to ask, why is it that white should be frightened of competing on an equal basis with these inferior people? It doesn't make sense.
Tutu traveled widely throughout the 1980s. His speeches focused the world on South Africa's struggle for justice.
Apartheid is as evil, as immoral, as unchristian in my view, as Nazism. And in my view, the Reagan administration's support and collaboration with it is equally immoral, evil, and totally unchristian without remainder.
In 1986, when he came under fire from the apartheid government for his international trips urging Western sanctions against South Africa, Tutu hit back.
I want to turn to the threats from government officials repeated last night by Minister Du Plessis. He, like others before him, engages in the national pastime of many white South Africans, Tutu bashing, knowing it will give them instant popularity, certainly assured publicity.
I am not defying the government. I am obeying God.
No one and nothing was ever off limits, including African liberation leaders and allies. He had little patience for presidents who clung to power. When Tutu saw Zimbabwe spiral into political and economic turmoil, he called President Robert Mugabe a Frankenstein for his people.
Step down. You still have the chance of salvaging some of your legacy. Please step down. You've been there for 20 years, man.
At a Hollywood celebration for his birthday, Tutu criticized the United States.
This is a great country, and it has the potential for producing tremendous good. And it has done so in very, very many parts of the world. And Americans are wonderful people, you know. And I'm saying we were inspired by Americans long before people ever thought to have heard of us. the anti-apartheid struggle. We were supported by Americans. We were inspired by Martin Luther King. We were inspired by our constitution. And we say, why aren't you true to your ideals?
In the United Kingdom, he was critical of the so-called war on terrorism.
If there's one thing I can say categorically, you are not going to win any war against terror as long as there are conditions in the world that make people desperate. And so you apply that all around and you say it's in our best interests to ensure that the other prospers.
Tutu was a media sensation as an outspoken giant for human rights. In the UK, he had stern words for the media about the way they reported on religion.
Most Christians assume that God is a Christian. You know, I mean, they reckon that God is a Christian and that God would say to the Dalai Lama, oh, you know, Dalai Lama, you are such a smart guy. I mean, you really are a good guy. What a pity you are not a Christian. No. Muslim terrorism. Have you ever read anywhere Christian terrorism? Hardly. Hardly do we ever use that term, but we use it quite lightly. Muslim terrorism, as if Islam propagates violence. I mean, we've never spoken about what happens in Northern Ireland as Christian terrorism.
At home, Tutu expressed chagrin at what he saw as an increasingly corrupt ruling African National Congress. His frustration reached fever pitch when South African President Jacob Zuma's administration refused to issue Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, a visa to visit Tutu for his 80th birthday. Zuma's government had reportedly come under pressure from China to block the visit.
Hey, Mr. Zuma, you and your government don't represent me. You represent your own interests. And I'm warning you, I really am warning you, out of love. I am warning you like I warned the nationalists. I am warning you. One day we will start praying for the defeat of the ANC government.
Tutu had a long and close friendship with the Dalai Lama, rooted in their concern for world issues. The spiritual leaders shared a wicked sense of humor.
He's not listening.
I will not listen.
Behave like a holy man.
See, you have, I think, great potential.
Potential?
These scenes are part of a documentary film based on a book about the lives and wisdom of the two Nobel Peace Prize winners. Always chuckling, always happy in moments that words could not describe.
So I really appreciate.
In 1994, when he cast his first vote at the age of 62, moments with his wife, Nomaliso Lia, or Mama Lia, as she is known. And wherever there was singing and dancing among ordinary South Africans whose political and economic freedom Tutu championed throughout his life.
Nothing they can do to me will stop us becoming free. I myself am not indispensable. God will raise others in my place.
Thank you.
the life and times of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Well, joining me now to discuss Tutu's legacy is his close friend and fellow anti-apartheid activist, Reverend Alan Busak. He says what's needed are 10,000 more Tutu voices, and that it's up to the younger generation to continue the Archbishop's work. Busak spoke to me recently from Cape Town. Reverend Alan Busak, so good to speak to you from Cape Town, our hometown, which is also, of course, where the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, or the Arch, as we called him, spent much of his life. Now, I know you have many memories of your friendship with him, so I appreciate you talking to me about those moments. Reverend, what was the first and most memorable impression that the Arch made on you?
Well, we met each other in 1978, that is the year that he became the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches. Now, up until that time, even though all of our churches, except for the explicit whiteness of the white Dutch Reformed churches, all of our churches had a membership that was far in the black majority. But despite that, up until the early 1970s, the leadership was always white. And even though in some of those churches that they used to call the anti-apartheid churches, or English-speaking churches, broadly speaking, who were far more outspoken against the apartheid government and their policies than were, say, our churches on the Afrikaans-speaking side, or the Dutch Reformed or Reformed churches in general, or the Pentecostal churches, even though it was a voice of opposition, it was always a voice of muted opposition. When black consciousness came, and there was a growing presence of radical black leadership in the church, so the younger generation, we found ourselves almost from the very beginning on the margins of the churches. For all sorts of reasons. But when Desmond Tutu became the General Secretary of the South African Council, one of the first things he did, that is why it is a memorable moment for me. He saw what a difference 1976 and the revolution of 1976, not just in Soweto, but across the country, was making, not just to the history of the country, but to the history of the church. He saw what we saw, that from 1960, after Sharpeville, and when people like Albert Luthuli was banned, and Albert Luthuli was the last outspoken Christian leader of the African National Congress and leading the defiance campaign right through the 1950s, when Albert Luthuli was banned, there was no Christian voice in the struggle. The church was so intimidated by the reaction of the government to Sharpeville that everybody went silent. Desmond Tutu saw that. He immediately made room at center stage for the most radical elements in the black church. And so when we talked for the first time in 1978, at that very first meeting, he said to me, next year's annual conference, I want you to speak. And I want you to talk about a number of things. I want you to talk about the future of the black church in South Africa. I want you to talk to us about, when all of this is happening, this revolution, what is the role of the church? And how can we be in part of the struggle for our people's freedom? Under his leadership, the South African Council of Churches took those bold decisions to join the masses in civil disobedience, mass civil disobedience. I know, because I formulated some of those resolutions. And he made sure that the churches stood behind that. And when it came to the question of sanctions and divestment and boycott, the churches took the lead. And he and I, and later on Beyers Naudé, went on this international campaign to make sure that that happened. That was even more than the moment that when he became Archbishop of Cape Town, the first black man to become the Archbishop of the province of the Anglican Church in South Africa. That was the moment that set the stage for a kind of new shaping of the history of South Africa in ways that we could not yet foresee, but that I was fortunate enough to experience over, 40 years. 40 years or something.
And it's so interesting what you said earlier. It really made me think about growing up in Cape Town's Pentecostal churches. And, you know, what was preached to us was to keep our religion separate from our politics or the country's politics. But young people who had been obviously conscientized at university especially saw things differently. And people like you and Archbishop Desmond Tutu sort of gave people license to see social justice and racial injustice in the country as part of one's faith. And so as two activists, two clergymen at the forefront of the liberation struggle, what was it like to have Desmond Tutu as a friend? I mean, what was your friendship actually like?
Well, he was a very easy man to have a good relationship with. What we shared was, of course, that immediate connection that one makes with somebody who is not only in the church as a colleague, but as a comrade in the struggle. That passion for justice, which we recognized in one another, and also the fact that we both realized that, look, if the struggle is going to have what Albert Luthuli called the character that molds not just the struggle, but the future, then the church has to play a major role in it. There were things in which we differed because he was less of a political animal than I was. And so he would go to a certain extent, but then he would say, I'm a churchman. He was a great man to be with, always joking. I mean, that what we came to refer to as that famous tutu chuckle, and the ability to make jokes at himself, and make jokes that other people didn't find that funny, but he roared with laughter at his own jokes until you laughed with him. I mean, it's a kind of. His way of life was a kind of invitation. So it's join me in the joy of life. Join me in seeing the humor of things. He always talked about God as a God with a funny sense of humor. To us as the younger, radical, more combative generation, Desmond Tutu always reminded us that, listen here, you got to go out there in the streets and you got to fight the police and you got to do all of this. But just remember, you cannot do this if your spirituality is not anchored. And so whether we went out on a march or whether we went for a conversation or whether we went for a meeting with some government person, always, 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 always Desmond Tutu would start with a prayer. And whether you are a Muslim or a Hindu or an atheist or whatever it is, you just close your eyes and you will pray with him. I don't think people may be surprised, but I don't think they ever took offense. What better way is there to be a witness for your faith than in those simple, ordinary, everyday things that he seemed to be able to be so good at?
Now, the Arch had been a vocal critic of today's South African government. Reverend, what did he think about the ruling African National Congress and the state of South African society and politics?
I suppose if politics were the ideal thing that Desmond and I thought it should be, I now these days talk a lot about the politics of integrity and decency, and honesty and courage and compassion that we were fighting for, and that we actually lived during the struggle, and that now is totally gone. I mean, it's unrecognizable in what we have now. And of course, once you are in the position of, say, leading a country, you are confronted with realities that you are not confronted with while you are in a struggle for freedom. And the politics of freedom is very different sometimes from the politics of liberation. And struggle, but the fundamentals of those politics must never change, because that's when it goes wrong. I mean, in the beginning, 1994, in that first phase of euphoria that we all had, where we all expected wonderful things are going to happen, and Mandela was such an exceptional person, and all of that, and all of that, and he and Mandela was very close. So it was more difficult to begin to see the cracks already in the ANC and in their politics. And it took us a bit longer to understand what it actually was that we were dealing with. In other words, I always say to people, one of the traumatic things that I'm still wrestling with, and I think a whole generation of activists like myself, is that the ANC, remember, we did not see the ANC after 1960. I was what, 12 years old? 14 in 1960. And that was Sharpeville and Albert Luthuli and all of that. Now, that was the image we had of the African National Congress in our minds. But the ANC was nowhere to be found. It was in exile with this, with that. So the ANC of our minds and our memory and the ANC in our hearts was not at all the ANC that came back from exile. And that is a traumatic experience to this day for many, many of us. And I think that was one of the difficulties that Desmond Tutu had to come to grips with. I think he died with tragedy in his heart, because none of us could any longer deny what the African National Congress was doing to South Africa. And with the fact that if the ANC, because of his position in government, it's the only party with the ability to actually make change in people's lives possible and bring transformation to the country. Everything that they had promised and everything that we had fought for, and they were spitting in the face of those who made all of those sacrifices. That is something that I think he was still dealing with when he died. And that is what makes me so determined that that's one of the things that we should take up and not let go of now that he's gone.
And I had read in South African news media that you had said, and I quote, "We will not stop until we have raised 1,000 more Desmond Tutu voices." And I saw this in the form of an opinion piece. Why did you write it, and who exactly was this message for?
Well, that was actually the memorial on the Thursday before his funeral that I was asked to speak. And it was not a written piece. It was a spoken moment. When people say, the last voice of conscience is gone, you know, I say to them, no, that's not true. That's absolutely not true. Because I have also the last few years been more engaged than I thought I would be with young people. I have met young people in many parts of the world. I have worked through our church organizations with young people from the Philippines, from Myanmar, and from Latin America. I was with people from the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. I have seen these things, and I am now at this point where things are worse than they have ever been in a long time. I am now more hopeful than I have been in a very, very long. I think these young people are the voices that are rising up. And when I say raise 1,000 tutus, I mean and tutu voices. I mean the voices are there. What we've got to make them say and to embrace it when they say it is that we want the politics of decency, because we deserve it. It's not just what we need, it's what we deserve. And we want the politics of honesty and integrity and faith and courage and compassion. Now, Desmond Tutu had compassion. Desmond Tutu cared for people. So the ability to speak truth to power, the boldness to say the truth as you see, to challenge those in power, to make those in power understand you have power that we, the people, have entrusted to you. And so we expect that you do what is right. And when I tell young people, if they don't, we should find ways of holding their feet to the fire. Everybody cheers because they know that's what I mean. Raising that kind of voice, raising that kind of consciousness, not giving up. And that is what I think those of us who have a little bit of experience should share with the younger generation right now.
And we're going to leave it there. Reverend Ellen Busak, always great to hear from you. Thank you so much for joining me. I do appreciate your time.
Appreciate that. You look after yourself. Take care.
South African anti-apartheid activist Ellen Busak there, speaking to me from Cape Town. Busak is the author of the book Selfless Revolutionaries, BICO, Black Consciousness, Black Theology, and a Global Ethic of Solidarity and Resistance. Now, we asked you on social media what you think Archbishop Desmond Tutu's greatest legacy will be. I'm going to read some of the comments we received here. Sengao Muligande from Rwanda says he was a champion against social injustices worldwide. Marta Zulu from Zambia believes Desmond Tutu's greatest legacy is reconciliation and justice for injustices. And in Uganda, Wanalia Nathan Obadiah says Desmond Tutu will be remembered for fighting to give a voice to those who could not be heard. Wisdom Zakaria from Nigeria says Archbishop Desmond Tutu was able to fight political bigotry, holding the staff of religious and moral justification. I saw him as second in command to Nelson Mandela in the fight against apartheid and racial discrimination. Aminiel Patel Ndamu from Tanzania says Desmond Tutu's legacy is wide, not all of it inside South Africa, but also beyond the continent. He was a great leader politically and spiritually and throughout society. And thank you so much for those wonderful comments there. I really do appreciate it. Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with the new African Union ambassador to the United States, Hilda Suga Mafutse, about her relatively new role and her initiative to bring together young people in African countries and in the diaspora. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on VOA. Welcome back. Now to my conversation with Hilda Suga Mafutse. She's the African Union's ambassador to the United States. The Zimbabwean diplomat was appointed in November 2020, succeeding her compatriot, Dr. Arikana Chiombori Kwao. According to the African Union, its ambassador in Washington is supposed to enhance and maintain bilateral ties with the United States and advance trade and investment between the U.S. and African countries. Ambassador Suga Mafutse says she wants to focus on the African Union's Agenda 2063. Now, this is, of course, Africa's blueprint and master plan for transforming the continent into a global economic powerhouse. And they want to do this through a range of flagship projects: the African Continental Free Trade Area, integrated high-speed train network, a single African air transport market, cybersecurity, among other projects. And recently, I invited the ambassador to tell us more about her background and her future plans. Madam Ambassador Hilda Suga Mafutse, thank you so much for joining me. It's great to have you here on the show. You're in your position for just over a year, and this is, of course, the first time you're on our show. COVID sort of makes us feel like we've missed a year, hasn't it? And so we would like our viewers to get to know you a little bit more and what your plans are for the office of the AU Ambassador to the United States. So, Madam Ambassador, tell us about your start in politics and how you ended up here in Washington doing what you do now.
I would say my journey began when I became an activist. Just having that in your mind to say, I want things to change. I want a difference. Things are not okay. Yes, I'm a girl child, but I think I can make a difference. And it happened that a rural constituency voted for me to be a member of parliament. So I became a member of parliament to ensure the rights of those people which are not coming to the fore in my constituency. I'll really say they loved me to bits. So from there on, I had to go and work so hard for my opposition party to run the elections. And from there on, the party president, you know, referenced me as an ambassador during the coalition time of Zimbabwe in 2009. he referenced me to be one of the ambassadors, five ambassadors, the slots which were given to the opposition. And I became one of the ambassadors. And I went to Sudan. I was in Sudan for almost 10 years. And I had a very good relationship with my government back home. And I had a very good relationship with my people from my country. And because I told myself, I will rise above and did not align myself with any political party. I would want to stand and work for my country. It's very important to me. And that's the stance I took. And I became a favorite due to that. From there on, my party left the coalition, but the party that was ruling kept me in because maybe of the stance that I took to say, I work for my country. I'm not working for political parties. I want Zimbabwe to develop. With the new dispensation, the president of Zimbabwe today, he says, if you're still interested in working with the government, I'm happy that you're working very well, and I would want to continue to work with you. Then he reassigned me to work in Malawi. From there on, the African Union just scouted for me due to the work that I did in Sudan. We worked so hard for the agreement that he became in Sudan in 2019, after those challenges when President Bashir left. We worked so hard. I made myself known. I was the dean of the African group at that given time. I would want to think that's where it came from, that I was scouted by the African Union.
Madam Ambassador, as you said, you spent about a decade or so in Sudan. That country has gone through many changes and political turmoil over the years. And of course, in recent years, with the fall of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir, a change in government and the challenges between the military and civilian leaders there, we saw coups and coup attempts. You know the country. What do you make of what you see happening there today?
Yeah, my thoughts, I'm actually just saying, coming to the table to discuss about issues to make things better is the only way out. Yes, people go as far as doing these coups and all that, but it will not help us. And because we should know right now, people have more rights, and people want to use their rights. So I would say, I feel for the Sudanese people, and I want the best for them. A place I stayed for almost 10 years, let me put it that way. What it means is my second home. So I want the best for Sudan, and I want the best for the continent, for Africa, and it begins with Sudan. So let's sit and talk about this, and put ourselves in a position to make a difference to our continent, to make a difference to begin with Sudan. I want the best for the people of Sudan. Let me put it that way.
Now, Madam Ambassador, you came into this role following quite some controversy around the exit of your predecessor in this position, Dr. Arikana Chiombori Kwao. She, of course, was a firebrand, very outspoken, and she was terminated in her position. The African Union, of course, faced a lot of backlash for that. The AU saying her term was coming to an end anyway. Her supporters feel that she was pushed out because she was very vocal. She criticized France for what she saw as its hold and influence on Francophone countries. That is, of course, a lot to navigate. How did you do that? And I respect that you are your own person. You're someone new. So what are you bringing to this office that is new and that is different?
The controversy, let me say, she's my sister from my country also. I didn't know about it, and at first I was told that I was going to serve in one of the capitals. I never even thought it was going to be here. And she was one person I was following in the work that she was doing. So I don't know what happened. It didn't involve me. I came after. Some would look at me as the one caused what happened, but they later realized that it wasn't my what I had done, but what I did was I came to this place, I embraced everyone, and they told them where I was coming from. And I had this mandate, which I had to fulfill. And I told them, I will work with you. to ensure I achieve this mandate. Me achieving the mandate means achieving the mandate for Africa and then making a difference to Africa and to achieve the Africa that we want at the end of the day. Let's work together. Yes, what has happened has been some are incoming now. Some were not happy with it, me being there, but it doesn't matter, it happens. We are a people, we go through such, but at the end of the day, you find that your experience helps you to navigate and to make better what you are looking at. And if you look at your mandate and they say, my mandate is to develop, maintain, and to consolidate constructive and productive institutional ships between the African Union and the United States of America. At the federal state levels, partnerships with the US private sector, all those things, academia, think tanks, foundations, civil society, in the African diaspora, which is part of the African Union, by the way, because the African diaspora constitutes the sixth region of the continent of Africa. So to me, I had to just run with the agenda that's, which I'm supposed to achieve at the end of the day. It's a new dispensation also here, Biden-Harris administration. We have also already vowed that we're going to work with Africa and we're going to look at Africa as a partner and not anything else. So we are so excited. These are so exciting times and they are co-joining with the issues that we're talking about of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. To work with them, to ensure we keep that relationship of trade together. We had our ministers of the whole continent at the same virtual and talking to each other on areas that we want to develop, make a difference on. So with all that, I would say I'm excited. It's taking shape. Just watch this space.
Now, Madam Ambassador, I've read that you are a big advocate for more investment on the continent. As you have mentioned, you've encouraged American businesses to invest in Africa, saying the time to do it is now. What kind of investment is most needed on the continent right now, especially with the pandemic raging as countries on the continent and around the world are trying to figure out ways to recover from the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic?
There's a lot of ways that we can co-join and make a difference. I'm advocating for Africa, for the continent of Africa. What difference can we make? I'm a very optimistic person. I mean, in terms of, yes, the pandemic has ravaged, and we are working so hard to ensure people are vaccinated. We are losing out on the issue of tourism. But we are trying so much to get these economies back on the front of that tourism that we're talking about. I mean, in terms of people knowing that as people in Africa are vaccinated, and I would want to take advantage of and take this opportunity to also thank the Africa, the US Biden-Harris administration for ensuring that they donated quite a sizable number of vaccines for the continent. I'm optimistic that we are going to conquer this pandemic and there will be a difference. We are looking at infrastructure. The integration that I also talked about to co-join our regions. You know us from SADC region. We have all those countries around us. We are saying, what if we do the co-joining of all those countries easily for people to move freely and the goods and services? That way we will grow our economies. We are building on the economies of scale of our continent. Let's have East Africa coming together. That's the integration that I'm talking about. In all fronts, in infrastructure, in the digitalization, in doing business, in the production, in all those fronts. Let's have in the ECOWAS area as well. Do the same, the Central Africa. the Maghreb, we are rich in Africa. We carry the trophy of richness, and we just have to tap on that and make the difference.
And of course, one doesn't have to speak to you too long to know and understand that you're very passionate about the African Union's Agenda 2063. Who and what, in your view, will likely be driving this agenda?
Look at Africa, CDC, what they are doing, how they've managed the COVID. Those are some of the examples that I can give. How they've managed the COVID challenge, why we didn't have many fatalities, but at the same time, I know one fatality is too many, but I would say as compared to other countries, other continents, we managed the fatalities from the challenge of the COVID-19. That is Africa CDC. We have done beautiful work under the auspices of the African Union. And I would say we had that. And as I said, Agenda 2063, which we are building, up to the 2063, 50 years that we put in place from 2013. And we have moved with the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. We're developing projects which include the Continental High Speed Train, the Single African Aviation Market, the Pan-African E-Network, the Grand of the Grand Inga Dam, the Continental Free Trade Area that I've been talking about from before, and the African Medicines Agents, to name just a few of the works that we are doing. So African Union is driving, it becomes like an axis on top in the push to have a work being done with the member states, the 55 member states. And when I talked about Africa CDC, there's trade, there's tourism, there's all different ministers in each and every country. And they build on that one market we are talking about of 1.3 billion people, one single market. To me, it will be the largest in the world. And we're working on that. We're driving that.
Madam Ambassador, thank you for this introductory conversation. We're going to have to take a break. And as you settle into what is still a relatively new position for you, but please stay with me. We're going to talk a little bit about your monthly webinar series in a short while, and we'll be joined by your partners in this project. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll hear more about Ambassador Hilda Suka Mafutse's initiative to connect young people on the continent and in the diaspora. We're with the African Union Ambassador to the United States. Stay with us. Welcome back. I've been speaking to Hilda Suka Mafutse, the African Union's ambassador to the United States. Here's more now from my conversation with her. She has a new initiative, as we said, which she says aims to unite young people in Africa and those in the diaspora. And she and her project partners recently spoke to me about it. So I've got the African Union ambassador to the United States, Hilda Suka Mafutse, with me. And now we're adding two more people to this conversation. These are the women she partners with for her monthly series. Nia Black Amuzie is an independent television host and media personality. She's the chief director of Nia Black Studios and the founder of Glow Up Africa. Linda Anukwem is the founder of Who's Who in the African Diaspora, and she's the host for the virtual monthly series that we are about to discuss here now. She does that in collaboration with the African Union's mission to the United States. Linda and Nia, thank you so much for joining us from Houston, Texas. Ambassador Suka Mafutse, I'm going to start with you again here. Tell us what your monthly webinar series is about. What is it meant to accomplish and for whom?
Yeah, this idea was developed by like-minded people who would want to see development of the continent. And it has been a brainchild of Linda, who got in touch with the office. How can we make this work? How can we make a difference? And Nia joined in as well, and it got very exciting for us to say, we have to have a forum where we speak with the people on the continent and the people who are all over, who are the diaspora. And we started this series, and they've been so very good and exciting. It's such a meeting that I look forward to every month. We had lecturers from different universities, as we were talking more on the issue of e-learning and how that we can get it to the continent and then make a difference on the continent. Because the issue of the COVID-19, it's like it's here with us, and we will not be away from it so soon. So the strategy right now is to get things happening on the continent, make them not lose out from what is happening elsewhere in the world because of COVID. The civil society, I've seen they've been joining us. I would want to see the private sector on this forum, because as we launch the African Continental Free Trade Area, we're looking into the infrastructure. We're looking at the integration. We're looking at a lot of things that will make better to grow our economies as Africa. I would think the route to develop, to move on, is usually done by the private sector. We are 1.3 billion people, if not over, and we want to build such a big market on the continent. And what does it mean? It calls for a lot of things to be put in place. The integration that I was talking about, the digitalization, and this climate change that we're talking about, how we correct these challenges that we have on the continent to do with the climate change. So there's a lot involved. So I'd say I want to see the private sector joining us.
Nia and Linda, you're both bona fide members of the African diaspora, but how do you parlay what you discuss during this monthly webinar into action? And here I'm talking about the kind of action that really benefits young people in African countries.
We plan to take these solutions, and we're currently doing it now, where we provide a written recap report to the AU office on what was contributed during that call. Because what's happening is you have diasporans across the US, you know, joining the call, and we're basically now sharing a network. And we're learning of different organizations that are currently doing something, but they just need, you know, more of a push or more contributed resources or the assistance of the AU office to help propel, you know, what they're trying to do for the continent, which also, you know, it also helps with the goal of the virtual series to push those solutions into action. So it's good to even find those organizations that are already currently doing the work and seeing how we can, you know, pull our resources together to work with the AU office to put those action, you know, put it into action coming from the AU office.
Yeah, and to just add on to what Linda is saying. So for instance, like Madam Ambassador has said, last month we talked about COVID vaccine distribution, right? Yeah. And so the idea was to find local actors on ground that are working to help with even distribution of vaccine, and then the AU partnering with them and just helping them in their whole approach. But one thing, as a moderator, one thing that I always say during the meeting is we want this to be a community conversation, right? I'm not an expert. I'm not coming with all the solutions. Linda is not coming with all the solutions. Madam Ambassador is not coming with all the solutions. That's why when she said it's intelligent minds coming together. So everyone just chipping in and bringing their ideas together. And like Linda has mentioned, we compile all these ideas together. And then the AU works on how they can start actualizing all of these ideas that were put together. And I know Madam Ambassador gave me heavy credit. I do want to give Linda the credit, because she's the one who, you know, really brought all of this idea together, pulled me in to moderate. And here I am with Linda, the ambassador, with you, Heidi. So it's really a blessing. And we're going to continue to push development on the continent forward.
Agenda 2063, a big theme I sense here. Now, Madam Ambassador, I know you want to bring more attention to it, so tell us how the diaspora figures into Agenda 2063.
Agenda 2063 has gotten us to a certain level with its flagships. In the diaspora should be working with us to make sure that for those who want to develop on the continent, who want to do, if there's any time, if I may jump to say that, if there's any time to do business with Africa, the time is now. And it is when we are unveiling all those areas of positivity that we have to talk of the human resources. For those who want to come to the continent to invest, we have what it takes. We have all the assets. And I would say this is the time.
To be honest, when I think about the diaspora and its connection to the AU, I mean, I think the diaspora values the UN more so than we value the African Union. And this is something I say over the course of the meetings that we have. I say this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity where, the ambassador to the African Union is literally opening the doors for us to connect, right? She's trying to bring us closer to the mandate of the AU. And so what we want to see is just more young people chiming in. If you go to the AU website, there is a division called Diaspora Division. And the idea is the people across the diaspora were catalysts, were the one way that we can truly develop the continent. And so what we need more is more representation, more people joining conversations, more people understanding that it takes a collective to make change happen and not just distancing ourselves away from the AU. So this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for people to join and really push the AU agenda forward together as a collective.
And Nia and Linda, for anyone on the continent who would like to join this webinar, how do people do that? Where do they go? Just help direct us to the platforms where people can actually join.
The good thing is everyone is welcome, because we do have actually a chancellor for a university from that's based in Gambia. She has joined since the beginning. But everyone could definitely, all you have to do is visit whoiswhoafrican.com/BMS and just pre-register, and you'll basically be on the listserv to receive the monthly meeting link.
And to add to what Linda is saying, we're utilizing social media right now, because that's where all of the millennials and the Gen Z, to be honest, all generations are present on there. So just going on Instagram and following Who Is Who African Diaspora, going on Facebook, on LinkedIn, the organization is very active. And just, you know, stay tuned to the updates and the flyers coming through.
Just to add on and say, I'm so thankful that the two ladies have mentioned to do with the younger people. Actually, we are doubling. In 2050, Africa's population will have doubled. There's no way we can do whatever we have to do right now without involving the younger people. And if they come to the series, I think we'll be surprised with the ideas that they have. And they're asking for the direction to take, how do we get there to be who that we want to be? So I would want to say thank you. Involvement of the younger people on this forum will just make that difference.
Well, ladies, I wish you all the best of luck, and I thank you for coming to talk to us about this. Nia Black Amuzie and Linda Anukwem, thank you for joining me. And of course, Madam Ambassador Hilda Suga Mafutse, thank you so much for your time. I'll invite you again on the show in future as we get to know you more and become more familiar with your work, and we'll see what you accomplish on behalf of the African Union here in the United States. I do thank you for taking the time to speak to me.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the fight for social justice and civil rights through the lens of South African anti-apartheid activist Archbishop Desmond Tutu's life. Here in the United States, Americans are reflecting on the life and legacy of civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. His birthday was commemorated on January 17th, a public holiday in most U.S. states. As VOA's Laurel Bauman reports, King's birthday also serves as a reminder that social justice issues continue to play a central role in U.S. politics.
Today I want to say to the people of America and the nations of the world, we're on the move and no wave of racism can stop us.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s rise as a civil rights leader began in 1955 when he spearheaded the drive to desegregate public buses in the southern state of Alabama. He went on to lead peaceful national movements pushing for equal rights. In 1964, King won the Nobel Peace Prize, and that same year, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, and the following year, the Voting Rights Act. The measures outlawed racial segregation in public places and discriminatory practices that kept blacks from voting.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
This week, the U.S. Justice Department paid tribute to King in a virtual forum.
Dr. King has had a tremendous impact on all our lives, and his legacy of hope and his fierce commitment to justice and equality remain present in our day-to-day work at the Civil Rights Division.
Many civil rights leaders say King's struggle to secure equal voting rights remains painfully relevant today.
What Dr. King is saying, give us the ballot so that we can elect judges who will be just. Give us the ballot so that we can elect representatives who will carry our voice forward. Give us the ballot so that we can elect people who will understand what a criminal justice system is supposed to be.
Earlier this week, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris paid their respects at the burial place of Martin Luther King Jr. in the U.S. state of Georgia, where Biden spoke about the ongoing national debate over voting rights.
It's not just here in Georgia. Last year alone, 19 states not proposed but enacted 34 laws attacking voting rights. There were nearly 400 additional bills Republican members of state legislatures tried to pass. It's no longer about who gets to vote. It's about making it harder to vote. It's about who gets to count the vote and whether your vote counts at all.
Republicans reject Biden's criticisms, saying they seek to safeguard, not constrain, voting in America. They also say they are alarmed over proposals to change Senate rules to pass a new national voting rights law without Republican support. Meantime, statues across the country that many associate with historical racism are coming down, such as this one of the Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson.
That these symbols are bad for the community. And today, we've removed that hate, and now healing can happen.
And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
King was assassinated in 1968. But decades later, his famous words still inspire many to keep working for racial justice, an issue that remains a central part of America's national dialogue. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you to my VOA colleagues for helping me bring you the show every week. A huge thanks, of course, to our affiliate stations, now airing Straight Talk Africa across the African continent. And thank you for your company on television, radio, and online. Until next time, goodbye.